This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry today, and thank you so much for listening. Well, this hour, we'll look ahead to the start of the World Cup. We're just days away from the first kickoff in the games. But how ready is Brazil, and how ready are its people? Plus, a profile of Team USA soccer coach Jurgen Klinsmann and whether the German soccer icon can help America improve its chances. And the return of Calvin and Hobbes cartoonist Bill Watterson has the reclusive legend of comic strips come out of retirement. But first, one of the biggest financial burdens facing young people in America today is the looming reality of student debt. It's more than a $1 trillion problem.
Hi, this is Jennifer. I'm calling from Glen Rose, Texas. My husband and I are drowning in student loan debt. 3 bachelor's degrees, 3 master's degrees, and 10 years later, we still owe over $45,000. This has inspired us to save every spare penny that we can so that our 3 children never live under this cloud of debt.
Hi, my name is Megan Morales. I'm calling from Seattle. I graduated a few years ago with several thousands of dollars in student loan debt, and because of that, my partner and I made a decision to buy our home in his name so it didn't affect my credit when I go to apply for loans.
We're getting lots of stories from you about your student loan debt, and you can weigh in by calling us at 8778-MY-TAKE. Well, here are some hard numbers. 2/3 of graduates from American colleges and universities leave school with some amount of student debt. On average, that amount is estimated to be above $26,000 per student. Now, in response, President Obama is issuing an executive order today ensuring that some students who take out federal loans have those loan payments capped at 10% of their monthly incomes. It's all part of a solution not just to ease the burden of student debt, but to help stimulate the economy in the long term and also perhaps stimulate Democrats' election chances in November. Of course, the entire proposal is not without its criticisms from the GOP. Well, joining us is Heidi Moore, U.S. Finance and Economics Editor for The Guardian. Hi, Heidi.
Hi.
Thanks for being here. Help us understand the executive order that the president is issuing today. This doesn't apply to every person out there who's carrying debt. It applies to some.
Right, exactly. It applies to people who have federal student loans and those who took them out before October 2007 or after 2011. And the reason for that little time gap is that there was previous legislation from the administration that already extended the cap to between 2008 and 2010, essentially. And what this does is that it limits their student loan payments to 10% of their income. And that, of course, is going to create a gap that the government has to fill. So after you make payments for 20 years, your debt will be forgiven. So if you've paid 10% of your income every month for 20 years, the rest of your debt will be forgiven. And if you work for the government or a nonprofit, then it's after only 10 years. So it's actually kind of a really big scope to expand the law that's already in effect. And it should cover another 5 million people. To give you a sense of scale, the current law covers about 1.6 million people.
So it's a pretty big expansion. Now, I mentioned economic stimulus before. And the idea here is a student has more money in their pocket, they spend more. That's basically it, right?
Yes, that is basically what all of our hope for the economy is based on, which is that we need people to spend more.
Insta spending. And credit ratings too, though.
Yes, it helps their credit ratings, but also it helps them move forward. Like young people right now can't get married in the numbers that they once did. They can't buy houses or cars in the numbers that they once did. You know, to the extent that they're able to buy cars, they're depending on auto loans and subprime auto loans in many cases. So what we have is an economy where it's really hard to get a job. And then once you do get a job, you'll find yourself spending almost all of your money just to catch up on your debt. And that's not good for any part of the economy besides just spending. I mean, it's not like people are running out and spending it on clothes or something. But, you know, they need to buy health care. They need to move forward in their lives. And they won't be able to do that with the level of student debt that's out there right now, which is $1 trillion.
Right. Say for a house, maybe important things like that.
Yeah.
It's one thing for Congress to have a debate on how to pay for forgiveness of federal student loan debt, which is financed, supported by the taxpayers. Maybe we'll talk about that. But if the president's signing an executive order saying capping 10%, who pays for that?
The government pays for it eventually. It pays for the debt. And also there are going to be lost interest payments on that. And that's going to be about $58 billion. This is actually what's held up actual legislation in Congress, which is Congress can't decide how are you going to pay that $58 or it might be $52 billion. And one idea under a bill by Senator Elizabeth Warren is that the government would impose a tax on high-income Americans. And if that sounds familiar, it's because that concept has held up Congress for 6 years now.
Yeah.
Republicans will not agree to such a tax, but it would raise $72 billion and it would capture the shortfall in payments and the student debt that's forgiven eventually.
So the Senate is currently debating that Elizabeth Warren bill. They could vote on it sometime this week. That's one thing. The House is completely another thing. Now, whenever anybody says they want to impose a tax on millionaires to pay for populist policy, look at your watch. You know it's election time.
Yes, exactly. The election's coming in November. And, you know, a lot of these executive orders being signed by the president are great. They're things that people have really wanted. They show progress in his administration, which has been hard to come by for the past 6 years. But it is not without its political calculation and savvy, which is that Democrats really need a jump ahead to stay in power in the Senate and to keep moving forward just as a party. They really feel like they're in crisis. And so actions like this help go towards the Democratic base and maybe even pull in, you know, an age group that can be very powerful as a voting force.
They're trying to light a fire under him here.
Yes, exactly. They really want to see more from the president in terms of obviously student debt was one major issue, but also other things, income inequality, unemployment, all those kind of traditional progressive issues seem to resonate with a lot of millennials. And Obama needs that to get to his, I guess you would call it his base.
Now, what do we actually know about how far a 10% cap on a federal student loan payment would go for your average student? Everybody's different, so there's no one answer to this, I'm aware. What do we know about what that really does for somebody, 10% as opposed to 14 or 17?
Yeah, I mean, it does a lot in terms of their ability to save money and spend money. But it's more of a psychological barrier, right? You know, so if you're making whatever it is, you know, $4,000 a month, you know, you don't have to be limited in where you can live and where you can, you know, what kind of job you take and all of that. So the actual impact is relatively modest, right, in terms of the dollars that you're giving away, but the psychological impact is pretty big. Now, one thing to keep in mind is that this doesn't apply to the majority of student loan borrowers because the majority now have taken out loans from banks, not from the government, those private student loans. And this legislation does not help those people who are paying interest rates of 10% or more.
Right. And there's very little influence. We've seen that the president can wave over the private banks to get them to relieve their debt.
Yeah, actually almost none.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Except on one hand, some banks might have had a discussion, maybe not, that more ability to pay or maybe a lower interest rate on student loans would lead to more mortgages. But I don't know that they think that strategically.
Yeah, exactly. The banks are desperate for mortgage business and they've been going a long way to try to get more mortgages through the door. But I don't think that they have managed to put two and two together in that way.
Well, the president is signing an executive order today putting a cap on some federal student loans. Heidi Moore, U.S. finance and economics editor at The Guardian. Thanks, Heidi.
Thank you.
You may have heard over the weekend that comedian Tracy Morgan was critically injured in a car wreck on the New Jersey Turnpike. The crash, which left one dead and two others injured, was caused when a tractor trailer swerved into the limo carrying Morgan and his companions. Now, it's still unclear what caused the truck to swerve, but the National Transportation Safety Board says it will investigate safety issues related to commercial trucking. Now, these accidents give some focus to efforts from the commercial trucking industry to scale back on federal rules. These are rules that limit the amount of hours that truckers can drive in a week. Right now, the cap is 70 hours a week with a set number of breaks. That's to prevent sleepy drivers and hopefully accidents. But a bill going through Congress has amendments on it that could ease the cap on those hours. That proposal would restore the industry's previously held cap on the 82-hour driving week. Well, longtime trucker Kevin Hayes pulled over in Kentucky on his way to Indiana to talk to us about the proposal, one that he says he can't get behind.
Well, you know, I'm looking at my steering wheel right now, and I would probably just hang it up, because I really don't look forward to driving any more hours than I already do. To drive 82 hours really isn't benefiting me. I'd just go home and kick back on the ranch.
And Kevin told us there's no benefit to drivers like him for the amount of hours to go up.
to me, it sounds like companies or perhaps the industry itself is looking to get more time out of a driver. Personally, I feel like 70 hours a week is more than enough. If you look at fair labor standards in the nation, it's the 40 hours a week and then overtime after that. We don't see any overtime. That 70 hours is straight time. We get paid by the mile. So therefore, increasing the number of hours that we can drive really isn't going to benefit us. It's only going to make us more tired.
Well, joining us now with an industry view is Dave Oshecki. He's Executive Vice President for the American Trucking Associations. Dave, welcome.
Thank you.
Dave, I want to point out at the top, this is reported by the Associated Press just today, that prosecutors say the trucker in the crash that injured Tracy Morgan that we mentioned at the top hadn't slept in more than 24 hours. Now, we can't connect that particular accident that everybody's talking about to this policy issue necessarily, but I will tell you that a report that that driver hadn't slept in 24 hours is going to get people talking about sleepy drivers.
Well, sure it is. It should get people talking about what drivers do on their off-duty time, because it's obvious that driver, if that's true, that's the issue. The issue is what people do in their off-duty time, and not necessarily what they do on the work time, because there are rules in place to deal with the work time.
Now, you heard Kevin pulled over in Kentucky there saying that he thought that this lobbying effort, which is included in a Senate debate that's kind of coming around this summer, is really to benefit the big trucking companies, not going to really help drivers like him. What do you say?
It's not possible. The government, what the government won't tell you, and what the folks that are you may be talking with won't tell you, is the average work for a truck driver is 52 hours. You tell me if that's very different from the average, you know, employee in this country, no matter what they're doing. That's the average work week. The amount of time that the government suggests that they're trying to deal with is drivers who work greater than 70 hours. Unfortunately, there's nobody in that category, and the premise of this 82-hour work week is just simply false.
So how many extra hours could a trucking company have drivers on the road then? I mean, presumably they're not asking for this change because it would make them lose money. I mean, it would let you guys have more business. So how many more hours would you get, or is it just a change in configuration?
It's a change in the flexibility and configuration of a driver's work week. That's what we're dealing with here. There was a simple restart in the rules for a decade, and the simple restart was 34 consecutive hours. It was a day plus 10 hours. That amount of time allowed two anchor sleep periods, if you will. So the configuration of a driver's work week and the flexibility given to a driver to decide when they sleep and when they work, that's important to truck drivers. The other thing that hasn't been mentioned here is, you know, what would happen if the restart were in place? And unfortunately, what's happening, what we're seeing in the industry, is more trucks are being pushed into the early morning hours, which raises risk. And that's something that is of concern. That's something the government never looked at.
This is the idea that because of the restart provisions in the law, every trucker kind of jumps on the road at 5:01 a.m. right when they're allowed to, and that's a problem.
Yes, that's particularly Monday mornings, and that's a problem. I mean, the early morning hours and the midday hours when trucks and cars mix on our highways, those are the riskiest hours, and that's what this rule is having a tendency to do. It's pushing more trucks into the early morning hours in the higher risk periods.
Dave Oshecki is Executive Vice President for the American Trucking Associations, which is pushing for an adjustment to federal trucking rules around sleep time and configuration of when drivers drive. Dave, thank you for your views.
Thank you. Bye now.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today, filling in for John Hockenberry. Well, he's known as the J.D. Salinger of comic strips. He's a recluse, legendary in the cartoon world, and rarely seen. Bill Watterson, the creator of the iconic comic strip Calvin and Hobbes, published his last strip on December 31st in 1995. Then he retired from the business completely, supposedly to never draw another comic again. But our next guest convinced Watterson to finally return to the page for the first time in nearly 20 years. He's Stefan Pastis. He's creator and author of the cartoon Pearls Before Swine, and he joins me now. Hi, Stefan.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, and it's good to have you here. Now, this all started with you pestering Bill Watterson over email, right? Tell the story.
Well, sort of. I was going through Ohio on a book tour, And I knew that Bill Watterson lived somewhere in the Cleveland area. And I also knew somebody, a Washington Post cartoonist, who was working with Bill on a book. So I wrote to this go-between, and I said, is there any way I could meet Bill when I pass through Cleveland? So he wrote Bill, and Bill had something to do, and he couldn't do it. So I figured, fine, you know, I get it. I'm not going to be able to meet him. And I thought nothing of it. And then when the book tour ended, that go-between wrote to me and said, hey, did you ever talk to Bill? Did you ever email him? And I said, no. I felt like I was bugging him. And he said, no, write to him. So I sent him an email, and what do you know? I got a reply. And all I had told him was, you know, I'm a big fan of your strip. And I sent him a little strip where I mentioned Calvin and Hobbes, the Pearl strip where I mentioned Calvin. And what do you know? He writes back, and he thanks me for everything. And then he says that he has this idea for a collaboration. And that just blew me away.
What's the idea?
He said that he knew that in Pearls Before Swine, in my strip, I frequently made fun of my own art. So he said he thought it'd be funny to pretend that in the strip, I get hit on the head or something. I'm a character in my own comic. I get hit in the head or something and suddenly can draw wonderfully. And then he, Bill Watterson, will take over and draw my strips for the week.
And you thought right away, I don't know if I'm into it, Bill.
I was absolutely blown away. My response to Bill was, I literally said, dear Bill, I will do anything you want, including setting my hair on fire. That's what I said.
I read that quote, and you're wearing a baseball cap, but it doesn't look too singed, so you didn't have to do that.
I did not. He was great.
So a cartoonist, presumably sort of my generation, I have to imagine that you grew up on Calvin and Hobbes, and that it's just incredibly important to you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for any cartoonist, I'm 46, but any cartoonist in my generation, Calvin and Hobbes, Bloom County, and Farside are what we call the big three, the strips that influenced all of us. But Watterson is even sort of beyond that in the sense that he has this reputation that he doesn't basically come out of his house. So it's not only have most people not met him, it's hard to meet somebody who has met him. I mean, he's that reclusive. So when Bill Watterson writes to you and says he wants to work with you, I mean, it is so shocking. It's like the Pope emailing me and saying, hey, just thought we'd chat at the Vatican or something. I mean, it's that unlikely. Like,
so what's the plan for this process? How's it going to work?
Well, we already did it. We worked together for a week 6 weeks ago and went back and forth on the premise for the strips. And then he ended up drawing three of my strips. And we published those, and they ran last week.
Surprised everybody?
Yeah. Boy, that's a word for it. It blew up over the weekend on Saturday.
Sure did.
I revealed that it was Watterson that had been drawing my strips. And I mean, my blog alone is up to 3 million views. It's been everywhere from Rolling Stone to CNN to the New York Times. I mean, everybody was wondering, where is Bill Watterson? And the thought that he's alive and well and drawing comics again was shocking news to a lot of
people. Did anybody catch on to this before you made the reveal? Was there anyone who emailed you or tweeted you and said, I think there's something going on here.
Yeah, a lot of people. Because on the Wednesday strip, he drew shoes. And if you really know Calvin, the shoes are distinctive. And on the Thursday strip, he drew a Martian scene that looked just like a spaceman spiff attack.
Yeah.
So they caught it there. And then what threw everybody off, though, was Friday. Friday, he drew a bunch of really hot women, but he drew them in the style of Archie Comics. So then people didn't know what to think. But for those who thought it was Watterson, They could not take the next step and assume that it really was him, because they all thought the same thing. Why would Watterson draw Pearls Before Swine? Why would he come out of retirement? There's no way Stefan could get him. So, which is a really logical assumption. But it turns out they were wrong.
What's the answer? Why come out of retirement and why you?
I think the genesis of it was he wanted to create some strips that he could auction off for this charity, this Cul-de-sac Foundation. The money goes to Parkinson's research. So he thought that if he drew some new strips, his first in the last 20 years, that he could auction them. But of course, he doesn't have his strip in the paper anymore, so he needs one that is in the paper. So he chose Pearls Before Swine. And he told me the reason he chose mine is because mine, you know, it breaks the fourth wall a lot. He can, we can play with it. In other words, since I'm a character in my own strip, it's easy to set up a premise where something happens to me and I can draw. So, but for, you know, whatever reason he did it, boy, I sure am the beneficiary of something great.
Sure, but on the other hand, this entire premise presupposes that one of your heroes was reading you in the first place. Somebody calls me up and say, Howard Stern really wants to work with you. You know, just a radio legend, somebody who's a god in the business.
Yeah, that I first learned that in my – so but going back and forth working on these strips with Bill, he didn't want to do it by phone. So we did it all via email. But when we did it, he said a few things that indicated he had been reading the strip. And then when he gave his interview, his one and only interview to the Washington Post, he told him he had been reading it for years. And believe me, there is no bigger badge of honor in cartooning than to be able to say Bill Watterson reads your strip. I mean, that's I'll never get a higher award than that. It's all downhill from here.
So the ultimate fanboy experience for you, Stephan Pastis, has become a pleasure and a joy and an unexpected gift really for the rest of the world, hasn't it? I mean, that's got to make you feel great.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad that you came in to talk to us about it. It's a wonderful story. Blew up over the weekend. Stephan Pastis is creator and author of the cartoon Pearls Before Swine, recently collaborated with, well, nobody big, just Bill Watterson from Calvin and Hobbes. Coming up, a look at German soccer legend turned U.S. coach Jurgen Klinsmann and his hopes for Team USA in this year's World Cup. And with the World Cup just days away, we're asking you this week for your game day rituals. From Springfield, Illinois, I'm a Bears fan. I just pray. From Spartan, New Jersey, whatever I'm doing when my team scores a touchdown, I continue to do that for the rest of the game. And this comes from Philadelphia. I get on my Harley-Davidson and drive away to avoid hearing my friends and family yelling at the TV. Now there's a ritual. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
What's your take? Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253. Let's go to the NBA now, where LeBron James took out his frustration with all his detractors and faulty air conditioners on the court last night. 35 points in a Miami Heat win over the San Antonio Spurs. That's game two of the finals. So the series is all tied up, but there's a lot of time left for anything to happen. We want to go right now to the best sports analysts that we know on this show. How about two super fans, Jordan Melnick down there at WLRN in Miami. Hi, Jordan.
Hello, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Oh, great to have you. Giovanna Carolla from KSTX in San Antonio, Spurs fan. Hi, Giovanna.
Hello there. How are you?
Good to have you. Jordan, you know, they're calling your guy LeCramp, right? But he answered him last night.
Yeah, he did. I mean, I think that that was... you know, always going to light a fire under him. And it was overblown, as it usually is in sports and with LeBron in particular. You know, he came out last night, had a great game. The cramp in game one was pretty extraordinary, and I'm just glad it didn't happen again.
Giovanna, are you gratified a little bit in this battle on the court that everybody's been publishing these maps on the internet showing that, yeah, the Miami Heat is this gigantic national franchise team, but when you break it down, the country's really rooting for San Antonio?
Yes, I'm very surprised, actually, because it's different than it was last year. And when we were headed to the finals last year, they were counting us out for being too old. And here we are again. Same scenario, everything. So I'm really happy that now we're getting some more support behind us besides San Antonio.
You're an art teacher there in San Antonio, right?
Yes, I am.
So are the kids, is it all Spurs and jerseys and basketball pictures this week or what?
Oh, it's been on for a while. And, it's all over our school. Anytime we have a game day, everyone is decked out in their Spurs gear, and it's just wild. We had a pep rally last week, and it's great. And it's not only at our school. It's everywhere in San Antonio.
So, Jordan, you know, Miami has this reputation that if you beat them once, they always come back, rebound off a loss, and they beat you, and that held last night.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you are an art teacher, Giovanna. My wife is also an art teacher, and she's been decking her kids out in Heat gear. But yeah, to get to your question.
No, this is war. Don't make friends with her, Jordan.
It's a tactic. No, it's impressive. I think it's been, you know, something like 10 series or where we've come back and won the second game. It shows that it's hard to beat a team two in a row, and it's going to be hard to beat the Spurs two in a row, which is what we need to do, you know, come home and hopefully take both games. But it's a tall order, but it is one of the more impressive parts of our team that we can rebound like that, because game one was a really tough loss. I thought we had it, and then it just slipped away in the last, you know, few minutes.
Giovanna Carolla, who's your man? Is it Manu Ginobili? Who's your guy on the team?
Good guess. He is. Yeah. If I had to pick one, I would say it's Manu. But yeah. I love all the guys. They're awesome. They're a down-to-earth group of guys, and they all respect each other, and they work together as a team. And, you know, after the first win, with all the hype and everything going on, they just focused. It's back to the game, and, you know, they're ready for the next thing, just like they are now. They're not going to take this loss and worry about it. They're going to move on and get back to business.
All right, so strategy, Jamana. What do the Spurs have to do, though, other than have super fans to really pick apart Dwayne Wade and LeBron James and the Heat?
Well, we know it's going to be a tough game. I knew it was going to be really physical yesterday, and I'm sure it's going to be twice as hard once we get to Miami. So they're you know, we've got to watch the turnovers. Their defense is going to have to be on, and it's going to get really physical, I'm sure.
And Jordan, strategy?
I think that we got to keep the Spurs off the three-point line. They were amazing in the first game, and I think just keeping our defensive intensity up. And, you know, it helps when you have a guy like LeBron who can take over a quarter like he did yesterday.
Well, Jordan Melnick, creator of the sketchy iPhone app, Miami Heat super fan, joining us from Miami. Thanks, man.
It's great. Thanks for having me.
Jovana Carolla, art teacher from San Antonio, a Spurs super fan. Good luck to you both. It's tied 1-1.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, at the White House today, the president does his annual ritual of meeting with the NCAA championship basketball teams, both men and women. But in the courtrooms, there's an atmosphere that's far less celebratory. The trial begins today in the case of O'Bannon versus the NCAA. It's a case that may have longstanding implications for the lucrative world of Division I college football and basketball. Now, the suit was brought about 5 years ago by a former UCLA basketball player named Ed O'Bannon after he saw his own likeness playing in a video game. The NCAA and UCLA had sold O'Bannon's likeness to game maker EA Sports without telling him, and certainly without paying him. It's a class action suit which has grown to include more players, some current, some former, and it argues that the NCAA is violating federal antitrust law by using players' names and images and likenesses in television broadcasts and on merchandise without giving them any money.
My biggest thing, again, is to right a wrong. I think if someone uses your likeness, then you should be compensated for it.
That's Ed O'Bannon talking about the case on Larry King Now this past March. Well, joining me now to discuss the case is Joe Nocera. He's a columnist for our partner, the New York Times, and a regular contributor to WNYC's economics and business podcast, Money Talking. Hi, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
This case isn't about Ed O'Bannon anymore. This is really about the NCAA's entire business model, right?
Well, to some extent it is. It's really hard to say for sure because the case could be decided narrowly or it could be decided broadly. If O'Bannon were to win a narrow judgment, we'd have something that I call the Olympic model, where players would be able to gain endorsements, they'd be able to sell their likenesses, but they wouldn't get paid for playing still. There's also a broader implication, which both the plaintiffs and the defendants are acting as if this is World War III for the NCAA, where potentially the judge could basically say the NCAA rules are anti-competitive, they are antitrust, and therefore we're going to blow the whole thing open and whatever happens, happens.
And the plaintiffs in this case, now it's O'Bannon, but as I said, it's become a class action, so there's lots of players who sort of joined along the way in a complicated legal process. But they're basically saying that the NCAA acts like a cartel. They've sort of said the price for your likeness, student athlete, is zero for you, but we're going to sell it anyway.
Well, that's correct. You sign away your rights to your likeness when you go to college and become an athlete. So the plaintiffs are basically saying, look, that's anti-competitive behavior. You can't do that. I mean, you can also say the only thing they give them is a scholarship. They're not allowed to make any extra money on the side. They're not allowed to take advantage of their athletic ability to make money in any way. And so the plaintiffs are also saying, in addition to the names and likenesses, there's this larger problem, which is that basically the NCAA is running a multi-billion dollar business with a free labor force.
The NCAA here says, no, wait a second, a scholarship is worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, not only tuition, but room and board, food. These players are compensated. And they signed on the dotted line. We can use their likeness.
I mean, from my point of view, the question is not whether a scholarship has value, whether room and board has value. The problem is that it's all capped, that basically this cartel has decided you will get X and no more than X.
Meaning you'll get the value of your scholarship, but there's never going to be another dollar in payment.
That's right. That's right. And if you do take a dollar in payment, you'll become ineligible and you won't be able to play. And so not only does the cartel keep costs down, but they really have enormous power over the ability of players to play.
Now, taking a step back from this, Joe Nocera, I mean, amateurism is dead. We've recognized a long time ago that NCAA players, at least in Division I, who get on television and provide a multi-billion-dollar product for schools and the divisions, are pros. It's just a question of how they're paid now, isn't it?
Well,
come on.
My own view is that they should get paid. And I think the reason people are offended by what the NCAA does is precisely because there is so much money in the sport, in football and college basketball. And Nick Saban just recently signed a contract that will pay him $6.9 million a year. He's the coach at Alabama. Conference commissioners make $1 million or $2 million. I mean, everybody up and down the line is making money except the players. There was a time when the money was much smaller when you could say, okay, you know, the players should get nothing. That's fine. But now it's an untenable situation.
A class action lawsuit after Ed O'Bannon and lots of other players saw themselves playing in video games made by EA Sports can have a huge impact on the business model of the NCAA. Joe Nocera, columnist for our partner, the New York Times. Joe, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you today. Well, we are just days away from the start of the 2014 World Cup in Brazil. Now, the tournament has put Brazil on the worldwide stage and in a lot of ways has become a lens on Brazil's political strife and inequality. Brazilian taxpayers covered $3.5 billion of the total $12 billion cost of the World Cup, the most expensive tournament ever. And hosting the mega event has come with a lot of mega problems, including highlighting widespread corruption, embezzlement, and what's viewed by millions as a disregard for the interest of the poor and the middle class in Brazil. Now, all this comes as the country is also getting ready to hold elections this fall. We want to get a sense of what the mood is leading up to the tournament among ordinary Brazilians in these final days before the World Cup starts. Rodrigo Bindao was born and raised in Brazil, but now he lives here in Queens, in New York. He grew up in Rio, and his mother and sister are still there in an apartment just four blocks from the Maracana Stadium. Do I have that right?
That's correct, yeah. They live just at the very start of Vila Isabel, which is walking distance from Maracana.
If people need to know, it is the Yankee Stadium of Brazilian soccer times 100.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's huge. Yeah.
Well, you're hearing, Rodrigo, this conversation that we're having about the political and economic strife that's going on in your country, sort of grafted onto like the most glorious sports event, cultural event probably the country could experience. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's true that a lot of sectors have used the World Cup to put forward some of the demands that they've been asking for a while. But it wouldn't be fair to ask them to wait for the World Cup to end, you know, to stay as things are and to sort of just wait until the foreigners come and have a good time and then, you know, demand what they really need to demand. So I think that the protests right now are a continuation of what happened last year. And I think that people are no longer resigned in Brazil. They really feel like they have the right to go on the streets and protests. And as a matter of fact, the protests have been mostly peaceful. And if we had some problems, they've been because of police brutality and the way that police have been responding to these protests.
Well, in that sense, then, is this heartening to you, given the legendary social inequality that exists across Latin America, but in this case, in Brazil in particular, these days, there are a lot of problems, but you seem to sort of be gratified by a democratic process going on there.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's been really good to see people on the streets and really have their anger used in a positive way. You know, I think that there were some sad events and there were deaths that happened since the protests last year. But to me, it's been mostly a positive development in Brazil. And I think what people need to understand is that the World Cup and the Olympic Games were so to the Brazilian people as a way to improve public transportation, as a way to improve safety, as a way to improve the quality of life in favelas. And the stadiums were built, but a lot of these other projects were not, haven't been finished. So people are, you know, have all the right to be angry and to ask questions and to go on the streets and demand.
And then what is your suspicion here, I should ask? Mm-hmm. Soccer stadiums and new roads that lead to the soccer stadiums are fantastic. They're on the world stage for a month. But people who need medical care, people who need a decent education or live in a favela with bad sanitation don't need a soccer stadium. What happens at the end of July when the tournament is over? Do you worry that the world turns away and sort of a political inertia takes over in Brazil? Or is this a moment, do you think, where real change can happen?
No, I think real change can happen, and I think this is going to continue going forward, not just because of the Olympic Games, but just because internally Brazilians are mobilized and they've been organized across sectors and categories to really demand for better living conditions. I think that public transportation is a big issue in Brazil, and Rio and São Paulo are very congested cities, and there hasn't been enough done to alleviate the conditions and to create better transportation systems for the poor and for the middle class. And that's a struggle that's going to continue. And whoever becomes president in October has to answer to those demands.
Now, speaking of congestion, let's get personal for a moment. I mentioned that your mom and sister live a couple of blocks away from Americana. What are they doing this week? I don't know that I would hang around there.
Yeah, I mean, they're really thinking about whether to leave or, you know, getting a visa to come to the United States is a bit hard, and it's not something that can be done overnight. So they're thinking, you know, that maybe they could come visit me. My sister hasn't been to New York City in the last 12 years. I think they're worried about, again, not necessarily about the crowds, because there's a samba school in Vila Isabel, and we're used to loud music and to people on the streets drinking, having fun. Mm-hmm. This is more about fear of tough response from the police or just Maracanã and that neighborhood not being organized enough to really, you know, respond to the needs of the tourists and things like that.
Now, if most Americans, Rodrigo, don't know about Maracanã, and most don't, and I didn't until I read a little bit about this, it is also the site of sort of a curse that hangs over Brazil. Yeah. And I'm talking about 1950. I'm talking about the last time the World Cup was there, when all the Brazilian team needed was a tie in the final game. They lost. Yeah. And my understanding is that this has really penetrated the Brazilian psyche for 64 years. Yeah. What's going to happen this time?
Well, I think everyone is hoping for the Brazilian team to overcome this curse. Now, this happened in the 1950s, so I wasn't alive, but it's definitely a story that you're told when, you know, as you grow up in Brazil. But yeah, I mean, they needed a tie, and at the very last minute, Uruguay won.
Right. Yeah.
2-1. So I think that the country went silent, and the goalkeeper, who made a mistake at the wrong time in the wrong place, sort of became ostracized after that. It's kind of a sad story.
Well, it's a sad story, and it makes everyone else wonder if there is an opportunity for redemption here. We talk sometimes in religious terms about sports, but it's Brazil.
It is a religious matter in Brazil. That's why it's so interesting to see not every single street painted right now. The mood has shifted so much, even in relation to other World Cups that were not hosted in Brazil. It is a religious matter. And growing up in Brazil, you can't but be surrounded by this almost suffocating soccer culture. You know, you learn to love it in one way or another, and I have. But yeah, I think Brazilians will come out and they will cheer for the team. I'm not worried about that. And once the game starts, people are going to be watching. And I hope that Brazil wins, of course.
But can Brazil find redemption in World Cup soccer in 2014? Can they find an answer to their earthly concerns as well? Rodrigo Bendao, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Rodrigo Bendao is a Brazilian expat living in New York. Well, here's a little Gilberto Gil to get us in the Brazilian mood here. But we need your help. Together with our friends at PRI's The World, we're making a map that's going to show you all the various bars and restaurants and clubs where you and your fellow fans can watch the World Cup. Tell us where you'll be watching by visiting us at thetakeaway.org/series/World Cup. Or you can always tweet us at The Takeaway. And we're asking you, what's your zaniest pregame ritual and superstition as you root for your favorite team?
This is Julie Stillman, living in New Jersey now, originally from Wisconsin. Every Sunday morning, I get up bright and early, put on my Green Bay Packer jersey, go to church, and pray.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and follow us on Twitter. That's at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. Now let's talk about American soccer. There's going to come a time when America's World Cup hopes rest with an American coach, but that time is not now.
Well, the first thing I had to do when getting this job was learn about the competition. We came up with a flashcard system in order for me to make American comparisons to English teams. All I had to do was link what I don't know to what I do know.
Manchester United, super rich, everybody either loves them or hates them.
Dallas Cowboys.
Liverpool, used to be great, haven't won a title in a really long time.
Also Dallas Cowboys.
Manchester City.
Jennifer Lawrence.
West Ham United.
Pickup trucks.
That's Jason Sudeikis playing the spoof coach Ted Lasso on NBC. Well, Team USA has the real deal. He's Jurgen Klinsmann. He's won just about everything there is to win in soccer. And with the curtain about to go up in Brazil, he's having to fend off criticism for being perhaps a little too honest about America's prospects. Earlier this year, he told our partner, The New York Times, he didn't expect the team to win in the World Cup. And a lot of people are still in shock over Klinsmann's decision to drop Landon Donovan from the American roster. And though you can argue long and hard over who should and shouldn't be on the team, how much do we really know about this iconic German who's lived in California for more than 15 years? Well, the BBC's Peter Bowes recently sat down with Jurgen Klinsmann. And Peter, for those who don't know just who Jurgen Klinsmann is, who exactly is he?
Well, I think he is arguably one of the world's best players of all time. Certainly a huge name in the sport as a player turned manager stroke coach. And his heyday, I think, in terms of a player was in the 70s to late 90s. And he really did play for some of the biggest clubs in Europe, notably VfB Stuttgart, Inter Milan in Italy, Tottenham Hotspur, Spurs in the UK, Bayern Munich, a team which he went on to manage. And the list goes on. He coached the German national team, actually controversially, while living here in California, then moved to the US full-time, and that's when he started to coach the US team from 2011. He has plenty of World Cup experience, by the way, notably helping the German national team to victory back in 1990.
Well, that's a great resume, Peter, but does playing for some of the top clubs in Europe, in England, and in the Bundesliga, and the German national team really prepare him for American soccer?
I think it certainly prepared him in a way. It made him the coach that he is, and certainly building on his great career as a player. But I think as he very quickly realised, if he didn't realise it already, having travelled extensively, sport in the United States is different. And that includes soccer, stroke football, as we refer to it constantly. And he's made the comparisons, he's made studies with US sports. But I think the key thing that he has in his mind when he's dealing with players at the highest level here in the United States is that it doesn't really matter what his pedigree is. They have to gain his respect as a coach.
I don't think that it necessarily helps you big time now saying, okay, but I played for whatever, Inter Milan and Tottenham and Bayern Munich or whatever. It is, I think, the most credibility you earn with a player is to help him in the present and for his near future with the right information and the right tone in order to take his career in his own hands and make those steps. You know, so I'm a big believer in that maybe is the influence of the American side of it in empowerment.
Well, that's all fine, Peter Bowes, but American sports fans are used to coaches who really rule a team or at least set the emotional tone. Think of Phil Jackson in the NBA or Pat Riley, these legendary coaches who are largely held responsible for the success of their teams. Is that the kind of role that Klinsmann can play on a soccer club?
I don't think it is, and I don't really think he sets out to do that. And in part, this goes to his own personality. He is in many senses very, very Californian. He's still got that German sort of stoic personality, but he is, to all intents and purposes, very Californian in his outlook. He's lean and he's bronzed and he's very laid back. And that laid back approach doesn't necessarily go with perhaps the more aggressive style that you refer to as a coach in a U.S. sport. And I think he believes in that.
It's very opposite to the other American sports, baseball, football, even basketball. You can call timeouts and you have always stops and you can explain things. I think over time, a real big player learns to take the coach's messages the right way, learns to read the messages, learns to take it for him in order to improve. Because you have, let's say, 20, 25 players on a roster, and there's no coach in the world that has the right tone for every one of those 25. Doesn't exist.
Well, that does sound kind of zen and a little bit Californian, Peter Bowes. But in terms of sports, how very un-American. I mean, we Americans love our playbooks, our superstar athletes, our set plays, our commercials. And this tournament and this coach doesn't seem to be offering any of that. Listen to Klinsmann here.
Just following American football with its amazing technology backbone of breaking down every play, studying it, you know, giving playbooks out to players that they have to, when they come in the college system, the first year, the rookie year, they have to study about 100 and 120 plays. It's unthinkable in football that we would do that in soccer. You know, you give them 20 different corner kick variations and they have to learn them inside out and call them by name. Try that. You know, you will lose your team after 2 weeks of work.
Peter Bowes, I'm going to be the one who dives into some maybe national stereotypes here, but Jurgen Klinsmann sounds like sort of the opposite of the German that we're used to, the methodical playbook style leadership that Americans think Germans are all about.
But I think his relatively quiet demeanor, his laid-back style, hides that steely reserve, that gritty determination to win. And he still has that. And his pedigree and his background shows that he can achieve that. So I think he is he's a relatively quiet guy. But basically, I think he knows what he's doing.
And Peter, you asked Jurgen Klinsmann about the chances of the United States making it out of Group G. Listen.
We understand it's going to be difficult, but nothing is impossible, you know, and that comes a little bit the Barack Obama approach is, yes, yes, we can.
And you call it the group of death?
We call it a group of death from our perspective, because it's obviously not the group of death from Portugal or from Portuguese or from the German perspective.
Peter Bowes, I don't know, with Barack Obama sitting at about 43% approval rating, maybe you don't want to really invoke him going into a tournament like this. I don't know.
Yeah, I think he's aware of that as well. And well, he's just trying to pull out everything, to just use every analogy possible, I think, to give this a positive spin. It's certainly going to make for an exciting World Cup, though.
Well, the United States has recruited a legendary German player to lead its side in the group of death, Group G, in the World Cup. That's Jurgen Klinsmann, one of the greatest players of all time. Can he make a difference for the perennially underdog USA soccer team? Peter Bowes of the BBC, thank you.
Many thanks. You're very welcome.
Ela é amiga da minha mulher.
We're getting ready for Thursday's kickoff in Brazil, and you can too. Here's a couple things we want to share with you. First, today's edition of PRI's The World is devoted entirely to the World Cup. There's more information on that at thetakeaway.org. And we really want to hear about your sporting rituals and superstitions. Remember, soccer, this is religion. We'd love for you to send us a photo of your team colors or anything that relates to your rituals. Use the hashtag MySoccerSwag on both Twitter and Instagram. Again, that's MySoccerSwag, all one word. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry, who maybe you're going to get to see in a USA goalie jersey. I don't know. MySoccerSwag is the place to find out. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results, because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com. TiVo, recording up to 6 shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube, all on the TiVo Romeo DVR. TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Ela é amiga da minha mulher. Pois é, pois é. Mas vive dando em cima de mim. Enfim, enfim. Ainda por cima é uma tremenda gata. Pra piorar minha situação. Se fosse mulher feia, tava tudo certo. Mulher bonita mexe com meu coração. Se fosse mulher feia, tava tudo certo. Mulher bonita mexe com meu coração.